It's November 30th, 1998, and I'm here in Durham talking with Anne Marie Viasana. Now, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this is Anne Kaplan with the Southern Oral History Program for the New Immigrants Project. That's my announcement. So, why don't you start by telling me so I make sure I have it, the proper spelling of your name, so I know that I have it right. Is it Anne Marie?
Anne Marie.
Okay.
Anne. A-N-N hyphen, M-A-R-I-E, V-I-L-L-A-S-A-N-A.
Great. Okay. So, can you tell me when and where you were born?
Okay, I was born January 3rd, 1957 in Chicago, Illinois.
In Chicago, mm-hmm. Okay. And to parents who were from that area originally? Or?
No, my... father was from New Jersey. He was the only son of Irish immigrants who arrived here in the 1920s.
Okay.
And he went to Chicago with a religious project.
Oh.
He worked for Friendship House, or he was a member of Friendship House, which was a settlement house movement in the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of related to, I forgot the name of that other Catholic group. It was a settlement house movement whose main purpose was to work toward racial reconciliation, racial integration, civil rights, before the official civil rights movement.
Uh-huh.
So people in this movement would move into poor African-American inner city neighborhoods and just get to know the people and just witness with them from a Catholic perspective.
Okay.
And my mother was from Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
She was... her ancestors were Prussian immigrants
mm-hmm.
that settled in Minnesota in the 1820s and just were farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And she came from a social work perspective, and she ended up in the same Friendship House movement in Chicago that my dad did, and that's where they met.
Huh, okay. And what were their names?
James Fallon and Virginia Lau.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so, around what ages were they when you were born? And did you have siblings?
Oh, I have. I'm the middle of five siblings.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I guess my parents were. I guess my mom was about 30 when I was born, and my dad was about 35.
Uh-huh.
I have two older brothers. I have one younger sister, and I had one younger brother who died mm-hmm. as an adult.
Mm-hmm. And... your father was an immigrant at the time that he moved into the house there in Chicago, or he came from an immigrant family?
He came from an immigrant family. His parents emigrated as
okay.
adults to New York, I mean to Philadelphia,
okay.
from Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Okay, okay. And on your mother's side, it was something similar, or she?
Well, they were, it was back further.
Further.
Yeah. They, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we're not from the Mayflower or anything, but...
Oh, no, was, I understand.
Yeah. Definitely not. No, no Anglo-Saxon blood in us at all.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. And so, what did your father do? Working in the settlement house, okay. they worked there.
Well,
and lived
well,
there,
first
or?
My dad. First of all, my dad had been raised up to be a priest.
Okay.
He was supposed to be a priest, and he had made it all the way almost through seminary, but he had epileptic seizures, and they did not let him finish because epilepsy was not treatable in those days, and they thought it wouldn't be, he couldn't carry out the offices of a priest.
Right.
When he had grandma epileptic seizures.
Right.
So he had left and become a chemist for like a year, but he was very depressed about that, and he wanted to be in some kind of religious life.
Right.
So that's when he joined the lay ministry as Friendship
okay.
House. Basically, what they did was they just lived on charity,
mm-hmm.
and they just, they had like a storefront
mm-hmm.
on 43rd and Indiana in Chicago, which if you know Chicago, that's like the heart of the
oh.
African-American, southern immigrant
right.
neighborhood, where the people would come up and work in the factories up there and live in the neighborhoods there, and my parents they lived with African-American families.
Uh-huh.
They just would knock on the door and find out some place to live where somebody would just let them stay.
Oh.
And they would just they worked, but it wasn't for pay. It was all it was all volunteer charity type stuff.
Right. So they were supported by the community.
Right.
And they volunteered their services.
Right. And they would just, you know, they'd also try to get donations from people. They tried to spread it out to the Catholic churches in the suburbs of Chicago to try to get the people to come. People from suburban churches would come to the inner city and work on the weekends just to get to know African Americans on a one-to-one basis instead of fearing them or, you know. You couldn't, they also had a farm in, I think, in somewhere in Illinois called Childerly, where they would take groups of people out to the country where they would try to do communal living out there, growing vegetables and stuff, and bring it back into the city and get the people out there to work on the farm and kids to learn about, you know, farm life, because they were about a generation removed from the southern farms that a lot of these people have immigrated from. They decided to get married, and that's when they had to leave Friendship House, because you couldn't, they didn't have married couples living there, because it was just a problem finding accommodations, and this was the 40s, so, so after they got married, they, my dad got a job in Madison, Wisconsin, and they lived there for a while. My oldest brother was born there. They went back to Chicago. They were, my dad was pretty much unemployed. They were, they lived in a tenement with a running sewage underneath it. This was before urban renewal. And when my second brother was born, they basically lived on welfare. They moved into a housing project, and my dad did get a job as an orderly in a hospital. And with the help of my grandparents, my mother's parents, they had bought a little tiny house out in the suburbs. They lived out in the suburbs for a few years where I was born.
Okay.
They did not like living in the suburbs because it was all, my mother said it was boring. They were too far away from all their friends. It was too white. And they didn't have a car. So my mother was sort of stranded out there while my dad took the bus back into the city. So when I was four or five years old, they moved back into the city. And we just lived, all seven of us, because by then my younger brother, all the kids were born by then. They just lived in a two-bedroom walk-up apartment on the south side. But I think they were much happier because they were closer to all their friends. And I just grew up with the house just always full of people, just always a pot of coffee on the table and people talking about religion and politics and, you know, everything from city politics to, you know, civil rights stuff, and then later Vietnam War stuff, and
And how would you characterize your family's position or positions on the, I mean, in these discussions, what were the discussions about?
Well, it was, I mean, they were definitely Union Democrats,
but
not white collar, because both my parents had college educations. It was like an anomaly. Here they were, extremely educated, extremely intelligent people, but didn't use these things to go out and get money and have a nice house and live in the suburbs and do all the middle class things that people did. They eventually bought an old, burned down, old Victorian house in an all black neighborhood to rehab it and just to live where they felt comfortable. And we went to a Catholic school for a while. We were members, we went to a Catholic church, St. Thomas the Apostle, which in the 1950s and 60s probably was one of the most integrated churches in Chicago, because there were black and white and all kinds of people there, which was different in those days. When the membership, when the enrollment in the school in the 1960s started becoming more African-American than white, the parish council, which was mostly white, wanted to restrict African-American enrollment, and my father protested. He said, no, you should take anybody who comes, and there was a big scuffle over that, and we were sort of told that we didn't belong in that diocese anymore, that we belonged in another diocese called St. Ambrose, which was an all-African-American parish. And so what happened was my dad had four kids enrolled in the school, and all of a sudden they told us, you're in a different diocese, you have to pay out-of-diocese prices. So that my dad couldn't afford us to send us anymore.
Right.
So it was kind of, we were kind of...
Yeah.
Shut up, you know? And so we ended up going to public school, which was a big shock to me. Chicago public schools were a huge shock coming from Catholic school. And I went to real inner city schools. Probably a handful of non-African American kids.
And how old were you when you started going?
I was going into fifth grade. Oh. So I think I was about 11.
Uh-huh. And 10, what 11. And what types of things were the shock? What?
Discipline, unruliness. I went from a classroom where there were 50 kids with one nun, where you didn't budge without permission, to a class of maybe 25 with a teacher. I just remember my first teacher in fifth grade, Miss Roberts, with her hair sticking out of her bun and just beside herself trying to control all these kids. Kids that were definitely from a much different socioeconomic status. Just poor clothing and no, huh? Mm-hmm. Unless the message might go on there. The message that she will pick
okay.
up. Just more one-parent families, probably more people on welfare, although I wasn't sure about that.
Yeah.
Kids that just live on the other side of the tracks, more or less, you know. The biggest difficulty was for my brothers, who actually graduated mm-hmm. from Catholic schools mm-hmm. and went from this altar boy thing to a public school mm-hmm. where they had a really difficult time adjusting to gangs, drugs, and that was a bigger shock for them.
So then, when you finished school, I guess you and your parents and your siblings, some of them, were still living in the house,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then what was your path after you finished high school?
After I went to high school, I went to the University of Illinois at Chicago. Mm-hmm. I worked almost full-time in a grocery store since I was 15.
Mm-hmm.
My parents had divorced when I was a senior in college. After I graduated from the University of Illinois at Chicago, I just became a waitress.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my own apartment, and I just didn't have a whole lot of ambition or anything. But in 1982, I decided that I would be a good nurse. So this was after I went back to Ireland to visit my Irish relatives. I stayed in Ireland for 6 months, and it seemed like everyone I met was a nurse. So I got this idea in my head to be a nurse.
Uh-huh.
So I went back to Chicago. And I enrolled in nursing school, and that's the same time I met Pedro Villasana, who was a wetback from Mexico, who was a cook. All through college in nursing school I worked at a restaurant, and just what we would call in Chicago greasy spoon uh-huh. corner restaurants.
Oh, yes. They call it that.
Which you don't have, they don't have them here in Durham, so. And you know, just a waitress with a pink apron, and I met the cook that day, and his name was Pedro, and he was a illegal immigrant from Mexico who had been mm-hmm. in the United States for a year and a half.
And what year was this?
This was in 1983.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a lot of exposure to Hispanics before that.
Mm-hmm.
I had worked with some of them in the grocery store, and I had dated a couple of Mexican guys, and they were all mojados, all illegal immigrants yeah. working in Chicago in the underground, and mm-hmm. mostly working, some of them worked in the grocery store with me,
mm-hmm.
But very few of them lived in the neighborhood I grew up in. They just went off to their own neighborhoods at night.
Uh-huh.
Pedro lived in the neighborhood. Uh-huh. He spoke English.
Uh-huh.
So in that way, he was a little bit different from some of the other Mexicans I had known.
Mm-hmm.
So we started going out, and I was having a hard time in nursing school because I was at a real big, one of the biggest hospitals in Chicago, and I just saw a whole bunch of trauma and a whole bunch of just stuff that I didn't think I didn't want to help humanity in that way as a nurse. So that's when I, the nursing school guidance office helped me take some aptitude tests and decide what I wanted to do, and that's when I heard about occupational therapy.
Oh.
So at the same time my Pedro and I were deciding to start our life together, I was deciding to change careers. So,
uh-huh.
I was also learning more about the Hispanic culture by, you know, going out with him.
Uh-huh.
I got accepted at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Oh,
and
okay.
We decided to move here. We had $500. We had a car that a friend of ours donated.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the furniture I had from the bedroom I grew up in. And we moved to North Carolina. And talk about culture shock. I mean, I had never been further than, like, St. Louis or, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I consider that the South.
Uh-huh.
And so we moved to Chapel Hill, and my husband was just, I mean, the only experience he had in the United States was in Chicago, where if he wanted to just be a Mexican, he could just get on a bus and go to a neighborhood and just speak Spanish all day, Right. His cousins lived there. He could have stayed with them. He could have just mm-hmm. maintained all his culture. He could have gone off to all the dance halls. He could have, you know, just mm-hmm. been a pure Mexican. And, mm-hmm. and but he decided he wanted to know English and he wanted to know more Americans. Mm-hmm. So that's why he had branched out and why he was living in the neighborhood that I lived in when mm-hmm. I met him. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we moved here kind of with blind faith, and my husband had a really hard time because this was 1985, mm-hmm. and the only Hispanics here in North Carolina were like campesinos, workers, farm workers. Mm-hmm. We moved to Chapel Hill. Mm-hmm. I was in a graduate program in occupational therapy, so I was really, really busy, and my husband was, he had never seen anything like this before in his life, like all the trees and all the open land and the ruralness of it, and he panicked because where was he going to get a job? So he did get a job in a restaurant, and you know, he was still an illegal alien without any papers, and you know, we had to, you know, do what we had to do to get him a job.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. and he had no, there was you could not get a can of jalapeno peppers in Chapel Hill, Durham, or anywhere in the Triangle. Uh-huh. Every Saturday we drove to Benson, North Carolina, to buy tortillas and jalapeno peppers because the Piggly Wiggly in Benson had an aisle that had all Hispanic food because they had so many farm workers in the area around, I guess, Johnson County or around there. I can't remember exactly what it was, but we used to go down there and get our supplies so he could have his jalapenos because mm-hmm. he couldn't yeah. just get them like you can now at Winn-Dixie, and there were no Mexican stores, and you just didn't see Hispanics anywhere except if you went out in the fields and saw them picking tobacco or mm-hmm. whatever, and then mm-hmm. they weren't here except in the growing season. Mm-hmm. So my husband met some other Hispanics through the University of North Carolina graduate students playing soccer. He was just driving around and he saw where some guys were playing soccer, so he would just hang around, and he noticed that some of them looked kind of Hispanic, so he sort of tentatively spoke Spanish with them. And so he met a couple, two or three graduate students, only one, this guy named Juvencio, I'll never forget him, that was a graduate student in chemistry from mm-hmm. Mexico. And the two of them, I was just like, molten steel, the way they blended into each other, you know? Uh-huh. Although they were from totally different backgrounds. My husband is from a very poor campesino, you know, farm worker mm-hmm. background in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And he played soccer, but he was really, I think the first couple of years for him were really, really hard. Because he didn't, you know, he met some other guys from Spain and Ecuador and you know, but they didn't have the same background as him. And
right.
He didn't have any family or anything. And in 1986, I was contacted by a social worker from the Raleigh Catholic Diocese. Mm-hmm. I was doing I did my master's thesis on Mexican-American farm workers and their orientation to time.
Okay.
It was kind of an off subject for occupational therapy, but I had done some clinicals. I had done my 3-month clinical at the UNC hospitals, and we had had 3 or 4 spinal cord injured Hispanics. This was in 1986, mm-hmm. and they didn't know what to do with them because these guys were just totally like foreign to the therapist there and to the nurses and to everything. They couldn't, you know, and these guys were like, to be in a hospital was just like waking up and being dead or something. So with my Spanish and everything, they sort of assigned these guys to me. Mm-hmm. And then my husband would come and visit them. And so those were the first, Jose and Juan, the two mm-hmm. guys that I worked with over there. And they were both farm workers, and they both had been injured on the job. Mm-hmm. And they were both left without insurance, and they were both left in UNC hospitals while their crews left to go. One went to Michigan and one went to Florida. Uh-huh. So they had like nobody, right. because people were not resident here. They were mm-hmm. transient through here, the farm workers. Right. So we ended up shipping one guy back to Florida. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think his wife came to get him and took him in a van, mm-hmm. paralyzed, to Florida. And the other guy just went to live with some friends, and his crew just abandoned him and went to Michigan mm-hmm. to pick apples. So, and I was doing my thesis also, like the year after that, I was interviewing farm workers on their perceptions of time and their orientation to time and how that fit in with healthcare mm-hmm. Attitudes about how you're supposed to get yourself better, and you're supposed to have all these goals, and they're based temporally. They're based on tomorrow you do this and the next day you do that. Mm-hmm. And it was trying to see how their time orientation is not the past, the present, and the future. You know, and so I did all kinds of interviews. And I was looking for a place to interview these Hispanics, and at the same time, somebody from the Catholic diocese asked me if my husband and I were interested in helping with some legalization assistance. Uh-huh. They were looking for bilingual people
right.
that knew something about the Hispanic culture and the farm worker culture mm-hmm. to help with the Immigration Reform and Control Act mm-hmm. of 1987, mm-hmm. where the farm workers were being, that being amnesty that you heard about.
Yes.
If you had work, if you could document that you had worked 2 months in the United States mm-hmm. as a farm worker, I think in a 2-year period, mm-hmm. there were real lenient guidelines. You could get your green card right. if you had the supporting evidence. Right. And I went to some training for that, and I learned how to fill out some of the paperwork. And my husband and I, the Catholic Diocese had been designated by the federal government as an intermediary, wow. someone who could actually help these people get this paperwork done and forward it to the Immigration Service. Mm-hmm. So I went through all kinds of training to learn all about immigration stuff and all about the new laws. And on the other hand, they let me do my master's thesis using some of these immigrants. So my husband and I would go every Sunday to Oxford and Henderson, North Carolina, and interview mm-hmm. these people. Mm-hmm. And that's where we met lots of Hispanics and mm-hmm. people that we are still friends with, people that we have mm-hmm. become the godparents to their children, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. just a big network of Hispanics that we are still friends with. Mm-hmm. So right. that was in 1987. Mm-hmm. That's also when I first met Father Bruce at Holy Cross Catholic Church.
Right.
It was from a woman who lived in Durham, a Hispanic woman, and her common-law husband, who were filling out immigration papers, and she was pregnant at the time, and so I got involved with her, helping her seek prenatal care, and mm-hmm. and I interviewed her husband for my master's thesis, and mm-hmm. She was a very staunch Catholic, and she kept asking me, can't we find somebody that would offer some Catholic service?
Almost.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess this woman, her name was Rosa, mm-hmm. had actually been going to Holy Cross Catholic Church, mm-hmm. and the priest there, Father Bruce Bavinger, spoke some Spanish, because he had, I guess, I'm not sure exactly, but he had done some work in Guatemala or Mexico or somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so she wanted to, it was her idea to start masses in Spanish. So mm-hmm. she asked if I would meet with Father Bruce, with her, and try to start something. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I was still living in Chapel Hill, and I was attending the Newman Center Catholic community over there. Mm-hmm. And there were several other members of there were American people that were young. Mm-hmm. Two of them worked at IBM. One lady was from Burma, and one was an American woman. Mm-hmm. And then there was another guy named David who spoke some Spanish. And we all came together with Father Bruce in the rectory sometime in 1986 or 87 to talk about offering Spanish or bilingual services or something for the Hispanic community. Uh-huh.
And were you already, you were more involved in the Newman Center?
Yeah, I was, because I lived in Chapel Hill. Right. The only reason I came to Durham was because I had befriended Rosa.
Right.
And she lived near the church, and she lived in a terrible, dilapidated house where the plumbing didn't work, and she was afraid her neighbors across the street were alcoholics, and they would come and borrow money from her, and mm-hmm. she was scared, and she was pregnant, and she already had a 2-year-old boy, mm-hmm. and she had some domestic problems with her husband, and so I befriended her, and... Mm-hmm. Another woman that was from the Newman Center was working for the Literacy Council and was actually giving Rosa English lessons.
Oh, okay.
And a couple times I went over there and subbed for the English lessons. Mm-hmm. And the English lessons turned into, can you help me call the janitor or the landlord to help fix this door that's fallen off the hinges? So mm-hmm. that's how I also learned about slum landlords in Durham.
Uh-huh.
You know? And I also learned about Lincoln Community Health Center, and I think Rosa was probably one of the first Hispanic Latina women that use the services there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a small community, and I think my husband and I probably knew every Hispanic in Durham at that time,
mm-hmm.
just because there were so few, mm-hmm. and we knew a lot of people out in the outlying areas. We moved to Durham in 1990, But I already started, actually, in 1987, I think it was 86 or 87, Father Bruce did start having a bilingual service on Sundays. I think it was once a month. Uh-huh. But it was an area-wide thing because St. Matthew's Church up in up on Mason Road was just getting started in Immaculate Conception, and so once a month they'd have it at a different church. But it's like, it seemed to me from just going to the churches and seeing what was being offered that they were doing it reluctantly, that they weren't really engaged in this. Mm-hmm. The person who was really engaged in this was Father Bruce. I think he had a real affinity for the Hispanic people. Mm-hmm. I think he has a real affinity for any ethnic person, a minority, a mm-hmm. person in need. Mm-hmm. And what developed at Holy Cross was a Hispanic community that was a part of the church but very separate. Because the two, you know, Holy Cross is mostly an African-American church. Mm-hmm. And it's a mission church. And it's mm-hmm. its mission was to serve the African-American Catholics of Durham as a mission. Uh-huh. Just as if you'd go to a third world country and have a mission.
Oh, I see.
Okay? It was to convert. It was to teach. It was to, mm-hmm. you know, nourish body and soul mm-hmm. in the Catholic tradition. And it was run by Jesuits. Mm-hmm. And so they had a long history behind them, which I knew about because I'm very historically curious and I just want to know the roots of it. And mm-hmm. and I come from a place that didn't have institutionalized segregation, although Chicago, you know, still has segregation and racism and everything, but it wasn't institutionalized there. Right. And I grew up where every institution I went to, the public schools, the churches, were right. integrated.
Right. Unlike the South.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I knew the history of Holy Cross. Mm-hmm. I became involved mm-hmm. as a catechist, mm-hmm. but my interest was always the Hispanic people because I just mm-hmm. I just you know that was a shared mm-hmm. background with my husband,
right.
and I saw the need there. Mm-hmm. So I know that we started catechism classes for the Spanish speaking kids, and it was separate from the other English speaking catechism and. Mm-hmm. or faith formation, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
We also decided to have a community gathering after each Mass once a month at Holy Cross
uh-huh.
so that people could meet each other and share a meal because there were so many people that were fragmented and segmented from their families.
Right.
And so everyone would bring, it would be a potluck once a month mm-hmm. at the parish hall. And it was still mostly all Hispanic. There were a couple of regular parishioners that might have a Hispanic background or just be interested in it that would come. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't a mingling of the African-American and the Hispanics. It was like two separate entities.
Mm-hmm.
So
you said at one point that this once a month service would alternate among
mm-hmm.
churches.
Mm-hmm.
But now it sounds like maybe it switched so that Holy Cross did have the service once
yeah, Holy
a month
Cross,
themselves.
I can't remember when the decision was taken. Mm-hmm. To have a weekly Mass.
Oh, a weekly Mass.
Yeah.
Okay.
They had a weekly Sunday Mass that was at 4 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it was about, it was probably before 1990
mm-hmm.
that it became weekly. I can't remember exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess, in addition, I think Father Bruce just had more people knocking on his door saying, you know, hablas español, ayúdame, you know, you speak Spanish, help me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with just it being a Catholic church and people spreading the word that Father Bruce spoke Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'd have people coming to the door, and also I think some of the Catholic social workers would refer people to him.
Once they realized.
Right, and so it just sort of started snowballing.
Mm-hmm.
And at the other time, the other Catholic church we didn't have the interest that we had from Father Bruce on making it a regular thing or actually establishing a home. I mean, it's one thing to go to church one place every week. It's another thing to be going around from church to church trying to form a community, which it just doesn't work that way. It's people are already migrant and, you know, then to have to figure out which church to go to on which Sunday. It, you know, it was much better that we you know, had one place to go. And at the same time, we had some, my husband's actually helped some of his nephews to come here. Mm-hmm. And his nephews are very skilled musicians, which my father-in-law was a traditional guitarist, and he had taught it to these nephews. Mm-hmm. And so they started playing at the church, mm-hmm. the traditional church music, Hispanic folk music. And that attracted a lot of people mm-hmm. because the music was just beautiful. And it was just, I mean, it was a place to go for an hour where you hear Spanish, you know, Spanish is acceptable, and you can come any way you want, you know, in your boots if you just come out of the fields mm-hmm. and hear the music and even make confession in Spanish to the priest, mm-hmm. you know, just talk to the priest about advice about, you know, missing your family or trying not to get drunk on the weekends or all the issues that immigrants have to deal with. It was a place that people identified. And I don't think that people ever realized that it was an African-American mission church. It, mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's where some of the problems that came later mm-hmm. developed, mm-hmm. in that it wasn't ever brought together mm-hmm. as one community. They were two separate communities. Another just a historical fact is that in most Latin American Catholic dioceses and churches, and I know for sure in Mexico, you never go and register as a parishioner. You get baptized in the Catholic Church, and you are a member of the Universal Catholic Church. And you can just go anywhere, and you're just a member of the church. In the United States, we have this tradition where you have to register as a member.
Right.
And as the Hispanic population at Holy Cross started getting larger and larger, they still had very few registered members. Although to the Hispanics, they would say, oh, yeah. That's my church. I'm a Catholic. That's the church I go to. Mm-hmm. Although their name never showed up on any rolls, right. And they threw their little crumpled dollar bills in every month, and they supported the church, but it was never anything on paper.
Right.
So there was like this ghost. Uh-huh. You know, plus a lot of people didn't want to give their name because they're still afraid of the immigration. They don't want anyone to be able to trace them anywhere. Mm-hmm. So they didn't want their name in a directory. Mm-hmm. They didn't want their name down on anything, even if they knew that it's the tradition here to register in a parish right. if you're going to be...
Too risky.
A participant there. But it was well known who came. I mean, for years and years people came and they never registered in the parish. Mm-hmm. Father Bruce was scheduled to leave Holy Cross Church, I think, in 1995. Mm-hmm. And a couple of Hispanic parishioners just became distraught because they felt that it was like pulling the rug out from people, that who would keep this going? Who would minister to people? Who would, you know, how... Could they replace him with somebody who spoke Spanish? On the other hand, there's all the needs of a African American mission church. Mm-hmm. You know who? You know. It was just I wasn't involved in that. I wasn't involved in the letter writing or the talking to the bishop or anything. In fact, I wasn't even really aware that he was scheduled to leave to go to another church mm-hmm. until like 1996.
Might need you to backtrack a little.
Okay.
I realize
I'm getting confused.
You'll put this in the way that you know
okay.
you think is best.
Okay.
In considering, you know, that people will be able to access the information
right.
in the archive.
Okay.
And I know that's something
okay.
to think about for you.
Okay.
But in terms of letter writing and mm-hmm. so more generally, maybe you could tell me what
okay.
at least the timeline.
Okay, I think never really thought this out before.
Right.
It must have been in about 1994 or 95 mm-hmm. that they were going to reassign Father Bruce.
Okay.
I think it's part of their order
right.
that they get reassigned about every number of years.
Okay.
People in the parish appealed to uh-huh. the Jesuit order that Father Bruce belonged to and to the Diocese of Raleigh mm-hmm. to please leave him at Holy Cross. And spend some more time to find a more suitable priest who could minister to the needs of African Americans and Hispanics.
Uh-huh. And the letters came from which or both communities?
I think they came from the African. I think I only know about the ones that came from the Hispanic community.
Okay.
I'm not sure what the African American feeling was,
right.
whether they wanted him to stay or whether they were all right with him leaving, and
right.
Because I didn't attend English masses there. I knew a lot of parishioners through my work as a catechist,
mm-hmm.
and I would try to take my children to all the seasonal activities they had, the Kwanzaa celebrations, not everybody was happy that Father Bruce was ministering to Hispanics.
Right.
I think some people may have felt, and rightly so, that it was taking time away from the needs of the African-American surrounding community.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that it was more than the mission of that church was able to accomplish at that time. Mm-hmm. To serve two different groups of people with, because of language and culture, had different needs from a Catholic church.
And you said at one point that you felt as though basically they were like having two separate groups of churchgoers. That, you know, were there any interactions? Can you think of any times that there were, or that there weren't when there might have been?
Well, when there was a building campaign to build the parish center. We needed to raise money as a church. And I know they did some pledges. I don't think that was asked of the Hispanics, because I don't think there was anybody there that could pledge anything. Mm-hmm. However, I do remember the Hispanic community decided to hold a meal.
Oh.
And all the women decided to cook food and sell plates of food. And all the money was turned over to the building fund. Mm-hmm. And there was a great that was one time when all the parish participated, because we served the food right after the English-speaking masses at 12 o'clock. And people flooded in, and they asked all kinds of questions about what is this food, and, you know, we had people from Puerto Rico cooking, people from Guatemala, people from Mexico, maybe some South Chile. One family was from Chile, and they just sold their plates of food for $5 or whatever, and all the money just got turned over to the church. And that was a nice experience, mm-hmm. because I think the Hispanics felt that they were contributing to the church instead of always being needy and wanting things, I worked very closely with the director of faith formation at Holy Cross, who's a wonderful woman, to try to get classes together where all the kids would be coming at the same time, even though some of the Hispanic kids may still need some classes where Spanish was spoken, or more bilingual, or where they feel comfortable. But I remember we worked on having the catechism classes all at the same time, so that people would be running into each other more. Mm-hmm. I think that started in about 1995. Mm-hmm. And we started having, like, the first Holy Communion celebration would be at one Mass with all the kids, rather than having the English-speaking kids getting their first communion at 9 o'clock and the Spanish-speaking kids at 4 o'clock. Mm-hmm. We had a Saturday service where they all received their communion, their first communion, at like a 10 o'clock service, that there was a little Spanish added in, and both languages were sung during the songs, and some of the Hispanic traditions and some actual African traditions were woven into the into that. And those were great times when we could do that, because we worked collaboratively. It was a lot of work, because it was doing things differently for everybody. It's like the Hispanics were saying, well, we do this and this, and African Americans were this and this, but there was a give and take on both sides.
Right.
So that was
So in terms of planning it, there was a real intense collaboration.
Right.
Is that what you said?
Yes. There wasn't. The problem is that the adults that need to be there to organize these things for the children, a lot of the Hispanic parents did not speak English, and they couldn't keep up with they didn't come to the meetings and keep up, because it was just impossible. They just with their daily tasks, and then trying to come to meetings and try to understand everything that's being said in English, and only some of it being translated, because there were very few of us that were bilingual that could be there all the time trying to translate for people.
Right.
So that was the language was a big issue. Now the kids, most of them were bilingual, and it didn't matter to them, and so, you know, they were happy to sing a song in Spanish or a song in an African dialect, or, you know, do an African dance or whatever. And so that's what pulled it all together.
Mm-hmm.
Plus with a lot of dedication from some of the other catechists that stuck it out and tried to blend the two.
Mm-hmm.
We had a couple times we had Christmas programs. Oh, one year during Black History Month, African American History Month, that's in February, they invited the Hispanic kids to talk about some Hispanic leaders. And we had a presentation where we got some of the kids together to talk about some of their role models in the Hispanic community, as well as African American leaders. And we did some Christmas programs where we integrated different cultures.
And so what I would wonder is, this is sort of on the side of some smaller groups, classes, and people planning it. Did you get an idea of what interactions were like for people who were coming to a service where maybe different aspects, you know, a Christmas service or a holiday service where, you know, you had aspects of Latino and African American culture integrated or on these few events at the meal for the building fund. Did you get an idea? I mean, can you tell me a little bit of what it was like?
It was never really comfortable. There were little comments said and little things done, and I'll give you one example.
Okay.
The piñata is a big tradition in Mexico, and you have kids wielding sticks.
Yeah.
And I remember one mother for a Christmas party where Santa Claus was there. There was a black Santa Claus, and everybody got a present, and there was food, and it was really great. And one mother had donated a piñata filled with candy.
Right.
One Hispanic mother had, you know, gone out of her way to have that. And so we decided to have the breaking of the piñata.
Right.
And I just remember the reaction from some of the African American mothers was that it was just irresponsible to have children running around outside with trying to hit a piñata with sticks, and they were just afraid that their children would get hurt or get trampled.
Right.
Instead of just realizing that we're going to keep the children safe, you know, we're going to line them up, we're going to make sure the little kids don't get near the big flying sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember feeling just sinking down when I heard those kind of comments.
Right.
That
because it wasn't just
Mm-hmm. Why can't we just experience this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we just try this together?
Mm-hmm. And when it did work, finish your thought.
The Holy Communion was, I think there was a perception that the Hispanic people got carried away. And they went overboard doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And the girls' dresses had to be too frilly and too big. And it just wasn't our way of doing things. It wasn't our way to do things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Although just some parents had that to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a feeling that they may have felt like it was just their customs and their African-American Catholic traditions were being just overwhelmed. And I can see that.
Yeah.
I can see that. Yeah. But I don't think it serves any purpose to snipe about it.
Right.
And not come to the surface. Nothing was ever brought to the surface about, you know, well, wait a minute, this concerns me in this way for my child's development as a, do you know what I mean? It wasn't ever brought to the surface. It was all this under brewing thing.
Mm-hmm. So you would just hear little comments or?
I would, and it really came to a head for me when actually, one incident happened at Holy Cross Church that really upset me. Every year since at Holy Cross, we would have a Feast of the Virgin of Guadalupe,
mm-hmm.
December 12th.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Virgin of Guadalupe is the patron saint of the Americas, not just of Mexico, although she appeared in Mexico.
Maybe you can explain for somebody who might be listening. I know a little bit about it, but...
Okay. In 1531, in a area near Mexico City, there was an Indian peasant named Juan Diego,
mm-hmm.
who was a converted Catholic. He was an Aztec or Nahuatl Indian. I'm not sure if he spoke any Spanish. He spoke Nahuatl. N-U-A-H-T-L.
I was close. N-U-H-A-T-L. Went too many A's.
Yeah, and he went to a church, and you know he was a parishioner, and he was interested in converting his other Indian brethren to Catholicism. One day, when his uncle was really sick, he was going to the church to take care of business at the church and to go take care of his uncle. And he was going up on a hill, and he saw an apparition. He saw the Virgin. He saw the Virgin Mary, Mother of Jesus. Except that she was an Indian. And she spoke to him in his own Indian language. And she said, slow down, well, you know. She said, slow down, buddy, you know, I want to talk to you. And he said, no, I can't talk to you. My uncle's sick. And she goes, no, I want you to go and tell the bishop that you have seen me. I have appeared to you. I am the Mother of Jesus. You need to go tell him to build a temple here. And he said, no, lady, you know, I believe you, but I can't do that. So he went off, you know, scared, and he went back to tend to his uncle. And he was afraid to tell the bishop. I think he did attempt to tell the bishop, and the bishop sort of shook him off. So he went back along. He tried to avoid that hill, but he had to go back over that hill, and he saw the Virgin again. And she said, you know, don't worry, I'll make it all right. You know, the bishop will understand you and will listen to you. And she said, well, no. He said, no, give me a sign. And so she made these roses grow on the hill. And the hill is called Tepeyac. So she made roses grow on the hill, and she had him gather them and put them in his tilma, which we would call it a poncho. It's just a serape. And so he gathered up the roses, and he put them in there and folded his tilma up like this. And she said, take those and show them to the bishop, and that's my sign, because roses don't grow in December. So he scurried off and went down to tell the bishop, and he was, you know, this was an Indian speaking to a Spaniard, and he was, you know, this must have been extremely difficult for him, but he went back to the bishop again, and he said, you know, I really have to tell you that the Virgin appeared again, and she brought a sign. So the bishop said, oh, okay, what is it? So he opened the tilma, and the flowers spilled out, and there was the image, exactly as he had seen the Virgin of Guadalupe. And apparently the bishop believed, and they built the church, the Basilica of the Virgin of Guadalupe on Tepeyac Hill, and converted lots of, through that apparition, they converted lots of Indians, because here was a member of their own race, you know, personifying herself as the Savior's mother. And the tilma, Juan Diego's tilma, hangs in the basilica. And I guess it's, they've done all sorts of authenticity studies on that, just like they do for the Shroud of Turin. So her feast day is December 12th.